keep him at the.
Was he down there?
In the garage.
Oh.
So I think you should.
Trying to make his way.
I hear your voices.
What time is it?
Oh, it's 8:31.
Mr. Tronso, it's 8:31. We started 8:30, if you recall.
I was bailing the mayor out with trying to find
some quarters.
Well, told me it was a 5-hour meeting. What's the deal?
I was halfway in the building when he yelled out to me.
My kingdom for a quarter.
Lovely girl sitting next to you at the chamber for lunch.
Yeah.
They kept talking about how great Richfield was.
Yeah, she didn't know who it was. And then, we have the chamber lunch. And this really nice girl from Richfield kept telling us all about the benefits of Richfield. And how wonderful it was. She goes, have you ever been there? And I said, oh, yeah. I'm the mayor. She's like, well, how do you know me? Well, I'm the mayor of Bellingham. And she just turned all colors. She had just given us the whole history of Richfield.
And she's very cute, so you don't want to.
Well, it was funny.
Richfield.
Brian Tass, City of Richfield.
Janet from Clark County.
Samantha Whitley with Clark County Community Services.
Michael Torres with Clark County Community Services.
Joel Johnson with the City of Battleground.
Pete Cabell, City of Kansas.
Jeff Brothers, Town of Yackel.
David Scott, City of Washougal.
Jeanette Santiago with the Greater Vancouver Chamber of Commerce.
Megan Dixon with Westby Associates with the CDM Caregiving Services.
Heather Jerzak with CDM Caregiving Services.
Eric Garrison with CBM Caregiving Services.
Mike Wilson also working with us.
Thank you. You had the minutes and you have a motion to approve?
Move to approve.
A second.
All in favor?
Aye.
All right, I think we're going into CDBG and home presentations. And with that, Mike, turn over to you.
Yes, we have. Sam is pulling up the slide presentation, so she has loaded, and CDM is our first one.
Well, good morning, and thank you so much for having us here to present our project. Again, I'm Eric. I'm the executive director at CDM, and this is Heather. She's the deputy director, and appointed. Okay, so a little bit about who we are. We were founded here in Clark County in 1978 by three community volunteers. and we take our name from the initials of their last name, CD and M. And they recognize the need for professional caregiving services for the elderly and people of all ages with disabilities. So we have clients of all ages, infants to over 100 years old. We're one of Clark County's 50 largest employers. I believe on the latest Vancouver Business Journal list, we were number 31. We have almost 250 employees. And our mission statement is up here, but basically it's to keep those people at home as long as possible because that's where they want to be.
So some of you have heard this term, silver tsunami, and that's really a thing. It's coming. You can see within about 10 years, one in four residents will be over 60. And 70% of those people are going to want to receive long-term care, and they're going to want that care at home. People just prefer to be at home, obviously. And it's still very effective for managing chronic conditions, and it's far more cost-effective than a nursing home or assisted living. We are one of the longest-serving providers of in-home care, and now we have an adult day center. The facility that we're using, we have done our best to make work, but it is basically falling apart. Last couple weeks, we had a plumbing failure that closed our center for 2 days. We don't have any more room to adapt that building. We've done everything we can, and it's hard to safely care for our clients in a building that we've just sort of put together to make work. So the adult day center provides some really important therapies. Nursing, exercise, social work. But one of the things that it does that's also really important is socialization and a sense of community. We had a woman who came to us in November of 2012, and her family had just taken her to the doctor because they thought she was near the end of her life. And the doctor told them that what she had was failure to thrive. That's all that was wrong. She just didn't have any reason to get up. She came to us and she spent about 3 years with us enjoying life and making friends and having a good time. So that really changed her life and her family's life. We also provide respite to family caregivers that need to work or need a break. We provide them with a free caregiver meeting each week to give them tools and a place to vent safely. We also need room for the training of all those 225 caregivers. They need training and ongoing support.
So this is our project. It's a $3.2 million project. We're requesting 140 from this group and then 110 from the city. The first phase was acquiring the land, and that was $300,000. We got private donors for that, and we've acquired it from Share. It's next to the Fraunhold Service Center on Andreessen. Phase two is building the 8,400 square foot building. It's with the Adult Day Center. It's got room for training our caregivers, and it's got the space for all of our administrative and supportive programs. We've got some other programs that we didn't discuss. The CDBG funds would only be supporting the construction of the Adult Day Center where clients come to us. So 73% of the funds are already committed to the project. 37% came from the state of Washington in the capital budget. 23% are what our board has diverted from our current lease payments to pay for the long-term building, and then 13% have come from private and individual contributions. The project is sustainable. The new occupancy costs are projected to start at $30,000 less than what our current lease is. So this is our team. Between Heather and I, we've been at CDM for 32 years. Paul Lewis, I think some of you have worked with him in the past. He's our contracted CFO and is doing all the financial oversight of the program or the project. Westby Associates, you met a couple of them here in the room. They do the fundraising and feasibility. We have a steering committee of community members that are guiding the project. And then we're working with RSB Construction, Olson Engineering, and LOB Architecture. So the outcomes, what would CDM get and what would our clients get? A customized space. Right now we've taken this leased building and done what we could with it, and we've looked around for other buildings to lease, and there just isn't one that meets the administrative requirements of an adult day center. It would increase, in fact, almost double our capacity to serve clients in the center. It would save us tens of thousands of dollars per year on our lease payments, which can be used for client program. And it will safely provide client care with increased security and sound infrastructure. any of you that have been in our building know it's really hard to care for clients in there, so this would provide us with the perfect space to do so. So that's it. Any questions?
Could you give the actual address?
2409 Broadway Street is the address of our current one, and then the new one is, oh, I'm going to need help here. It's on Andreessen. It's the old Timber Lanes building. It's across the street from Winco.
Shares the parking lot with Cher.
Just, yeah.
Oh, the new Winco there? Across
yes.
The street?
Yes. Yeah, directly across the street. There's a Les Schwab on one side.
Okay. I'm just trying to get it square in my mind where it was. Is going to be.
We do most of your services or all of your services as outpatient?
Outpatient, yeah. We provide service during the day at the center. We don't have anybody that stays overnight. And then we do have caregivers that go in, but it's to their own home. And sometimes it's at night, sometimes it's during the day. But we don't do medical services. We do non-medical tasks to keep people bathing, dressing, transportation, meal preparation, those sorts of things.
And how many do you serve? How many do you serve a day? Or do you have figures for whether it's a week or a month? Or?
Well, we have about 400 clients, and we provide somewhere over 200,000 hours a month.
Yeah, between all of our services, we serve about 750 people annually. The biggest one is in-home care. That's about 400 right now. And then the day center, I think we have 50-some enrolled clients. They don't all come every day, but the other day we had 30 in the center.
And then you would be buying that building?
We'd be building the building.
You would be, okay, you're building it from scratch, and then it will be yours?
Yes.
Sorry.
Can you talk a little bit about the timeline for construction and what your contingency plan is if these funds aren't awarded to the project?
So, as I mentioned, we have 73% of the funds right now. The state funding, we have until June 30th of next year to utilize, or else we would have to go back and reapply for them. So we're hoping to break ground in January. We have several grants. So we have a Furstenberg grant and a Murdoch grant and several other foundations. So while it would be a setback if we didn't get the funding, we still feel confident that the project is going to go forward by the time that we need to for the state funding. So we're hoping to be in it. Our lease runs out September of 2017. So we're hoping to be in the new building by then.
And what's your total budget?
Our total budget? $3.2
million this year.
For the
operating.
Oh, our
yeah,
total
to
budget, $6.6 million operating.
$6.6 million.
So assuming that you're successful in these two CDBG applications, what percentage funded of your project do you at that point?
Oh, Mike. What percentage would this be of the total budget?
You're at 76%?
We're at 73 right now.
73%, so we have 27% left.
So this, if you're successful with both the city and county CDBG applications, then what percent funded would you be at that point?
So we have to take combination against the remainder. I
want to say this is about a quarter of the remainder.
Okay.
Yeah.
You have to have a bigger beer festival, right?
We're working on that.
No, they didn't put one on it in Washougal. Or I guess not.
In Washougal, at the Port of Washougal, yes.
Put it on.
And the proceeds from that this year will be going to the capital campaign.
Awesome.
Right. If you receive both of the funding, you can get 81% of total funding at that point.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for all your hard work.
Thank you.
And Evergreen Habitat for Humanity is going to be next.
I everyone. Thank you so much for having us today. We're from Evergreen Habitat for Humanity. My name is Leanna Fabian. I'm an AmeriCorps VISTA with Habitat. And here with me today is Josh Townsley, who is our executive director. I'd like to start off by talking to you a little bit about some brief background on Habitat for Humanity, and then I'm going to jump in a little bit to our proposed project. Our mission at Evergreen Habitat for Humanity is to bring people together to build homes, communities, and hope. We do that by partnering with low-income families between 30 to 60% area median income to build houses and then sell those houses at an affordable, no-interest mortgage to help them break the cycle of poverty that their family has been in. We've been doing this work in Clark County since 1991, and in that time we've built over 30 houses in partnership with low-income families. Many of the families that come through our program have had a history of unsafe, unstable, or unaffordable living conditions. We also are able to provide a volunteer experience for over 400 individuals every year. As I'm sure many of you are aware, the need for affordable housing in Clark County right now is pretty significant, with an under 2% vacancy rate in all rental units and the cost of those units increasing steadily. Many families, even if they are able to find an available unit, they're going to be hugely burdened financially in trying to pay for that. Currently, 50% of renting families in Clark County are paying over half of their income in rent, which just simply isn't very sustainable financially. Habitat acts as a permanent solution for these families. As a homeownership program, families are no longer going to be having to be at the mercy of their landlord. They're not going to worry about their rent significantly increasing or needing to find a new place to live within 30 days or less. We're able to provide mortgages to families between 30 and 60% of the median income, I think I already mentioned, which they may not, usually they're not gonna qualify for a traditional mortgage for one reason or another. We also work with these families all the way through our program to ready them for home ownership through financial classes, home ownership classes, home maintenance classes, things like that, to ensure that they are truly ready to be homeowners. Land is one of our most crucial components of Habitat's model, simply because without land, we won't be able to partner with these families to build houses on. We're currently developing a 10-home development, but by the end of 2017, we will have built that out, and our current land bank will have been exhausted, so we'll need to find other places to be building homes. Through this proposal, we are looking to buy 4 lots in Clark County that are ready to build. And on them, we'll build 4 homes for 4 partner families that are coming through our program, and, of course, continue to provide volunteer opportunities for individuals in the community to help us build these homes. Beyond just building these homes, the impact goes further than that. We're part of the housing continuum, so people that are coming up through transitional housing or Section 8 housing come into our program and free up those spots in the housing programs. Also, all of the monthly mortgage payments come directly back into what Habitat calls the Fund for Humanity, which is basically a pot that goes that is directly sent back into the community through construction supplies and things to build more homes. Similarly, the more Habitat lots we have, the more houses we're building, the more exposure we have and the more exposure affordable housing has here in Clark County. We also, with 4 lots, will be able to increase our partnerships with some of the other organizations and individuals who we partner with to build homes. Thank you very much.
When you hold, are you the mortgage holder?
We are.
Have you had to foreclose on any of your clients?
I've had one foreclosure in 24 years.
And when you build these houses, do you have a set plan, or are you building to the neighborhood in which they go?
It's a little bit of both. We have the design criteria from Habitat International we use. We build simple, decent, affordable, so they're not extravagant homes. On average, it's a 3-bedroom, 2-bathroom home, about 1,200 square foot. But we also then try and match the neighborhood. For example, we're building off Middle Way near Lisa right now on Highway 14. In that case, we're doing covered porches because it matches the neighborhood. The roof pitch matches the neighborhood. Single family or single story because that's the neighborhood that's right there.
So a 60s neighborhood gets a 60s style?
Correct, yeah, for us.
And do you have any of these four lots currently in mind?
We do not, no.
So
no,
you would
market.
Just hold this money?
Well, we know the funding wouldn't be available until, I think, August at the earliest. The market changes so rapidly that, you know, as soon as we are awarded, we would then pursue some opportunities.
So you handle all of the mortgages that you've serviced?
99% of the time. The only exception is occasionally we will leverage those mortgages. So they have a 30-year loan. We will then use it as collateral to secure a loan for us that just accelerates those payments. So instead of getting their payments over 30 years, we get them over 1 year.
I don't recall the answer to this from years past, but how many do you have now under your roof?
How many notes are paying for just right now? I think it's 29 or 30. We've had one family pay off their note already, the first family in 1992. Their kids now are college, first-generation college students in their family. So we have a couple families that are probably 2 or 3 years away from paying off their mortgage. And then I think we've had two families that sold their house. And in that case, we actually took the house back and sold it to another Habitat family.
Yeah, tell me how that works. Remind me.
Yeah, so, you know, one of the things we do is to protect our assets because we're often selling these homes at below market rate. We price it at market rate, but then if the family can't afford market rate, we put in a subsidy so that the family can have affordable home payments based at 30% of their income. So if the family then decides to sell, they're moving away from the area, they've got a better job, want to buy a bigger home, whatever the reason, we have protections in place. We have the first right to purchase the home back. Often, if we're using home or CDBG dollars, there's actually a land lease in effect as well. So they own the structure, but they don't own the land, which makes it have to be affordable for the families, or low-income covenant. So it has to stay affordable for the next, I think it's a 20-year covenant for the county. We do a 99-year covenant on ours, so it has to stay affordable. And then we would buy it back. We would rehab the property and sell it to another one of our families that are waiting for a homeownership shop opportunity. We have 8 families, I think, right now.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we have 13 homes under construction, and we'll do another selection of families probably in June this year.
And have you built outside of Vancouver?
We have, yes. Yeah, all of our properties right now are in city limits. We did, I think, 16 homes up in the Five Corners area, Patton Parkway area, and then there's 6 or 7 homes off of we call it Tenny Commons, Tenny Road by Fred Meyer. Yeah, it's up there. Any other questions?
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Is Foundation for a Challenge here yet?
Yes, I am.
Great. I'm asking these, we're about 5 minutes ahead.
Development, and we're consultants for Foundation for the Challenge. Foundation for the Challenge is an organization, nonprofit, that specializes in providing community-supported living for people with disabilities. They operate in several states. We have about 90 homes, 24 of which are in Washington State, and Foundation for the Challenge is adding new homes each year. So the the house that we're, so the project that we're talking about, we've applied for funding for, is acquisition and rehabilitation of a 3-bedroom home, which would provide housing in the community for 3 people with developmental disabilities. They would all be paying 30% of their incomes for rent. So there's about, I think, 2,300 people in Clark County that have a developmental disability. They're eligible for services from the Developmental Disability Administration. There are many more that aren't eligible. But those people are extremely low income. They're usually just living on disability, which is between $700 and $800 per month. Those people, if they're living in market rate housing, usually are paying more than half their income for rent. Often also it's very difficult for them to find housing that is accessible, designed for their needs. A lot of times there's mobility limitations, so people need grab bars, roll-in showers, that type of thing, and it's difficult to find housing that has those features. So that's another thing that's a really big need. So each year, Foundation for the Challenge does a survey of the Developmental Disability Administration staff in different regions, and talking to the service providers, and just trying to identify which are the counties that have the highest need for new houses. And this was one of the counties this time. So this went in as part of a larger application to the State Housing Trust Fund that was going to be for houses in 5 counties. We were awarded $2.6 million for 24 beds total. So this is a piece of that would come to Clark County. That money, as I said, was awarded in December. So the dollars that we are requesting from Clark County would leverage $10 for every dollar. Basically, there's $430,000 coming in, $427,000 from the state for the $45,000 that we're requesting from Clark County. So as I said, the project's fully funded. The people are some of the most needy in the county. 17% of median is about what disability is. They will be paying 30% of their incomes for rent. And this Foundation for the Challenge only operates homes in the community, so they're really set up to do these small-scale projects, in neighborhoods. So that's how their management is set up, and if they're able to do it very efficiently and maintain the properties well. The homes, as the Habitat folks mentioned, it's really difficult to kind of tie something down and then go get funding. So we actually are waiting for funding, and then we're going to go find the house. We have some criteria. We usually look for houses that have been built since 1978, so that we don't have to deal with lead paint or asbestos. We look for single level homes so that we can adapt them for accessibility. We'll widen doorways. We'll put ramps in. We'll put in roll-in showers. We also, to the extent the budget's available, we'll do energy efficiency upgrades. We always do sprinkler systems for safety, and we'll do whatever. We'll extend the life of the home and reduce our operating costs over time. And usually we can buy the house and rehab it during the same year that we were funded and get it available. So we have Reside Residential Care as the service provider. They have people who are in unaffordable housing that we're lining up to move into this home. So it's a pretty simple project. That's basically it. I think that the wonderful thing about doing this in terms of single family homes is that people can really have a very normal life. They can be in communities near their families, and they can get to know their neighbors and be as integrated into the community as possible. So, thank you. Any questions?
Now, a lot of people you didn't mention much about the support, because a lot of people with developmental disabilities don't have the skill sets to live on their own. So, what level of support is provided?
Yeah, thank you. It's 24-hour on-site services, so there are shift staff that are in the home at all times, and those are funded by the Developmental Disability Administration. So, the people coming into this house have those services now and are getting No, lots in Southwest Washington, but not in Clark County.
Any
Okay, they're 20, you have help there 24/7.
Yep.
So you're responsible for the utilities and all of that. They just pay 30%, and whatever the difference is made up by you guys?
Right. Well, yeah. I mean, there's three people paying 30% of their income, and that usually covers the operating costs for the home. Yeah, there's an operating reserve that's been funded by the sponsor, and there's also a replacement reserve. So there's $16,000 in reserves that are capitalized, so that those are there in case there's any shortfall.
So none of your current houses run at a loss?
Right. I mean, a lot of them have some operating subsidy from various sources. Whenever we can, we do try to apply for operating subsidy.
Can this project still proceed without the CDBG funds?
We need local dollars, so we will not move ahead with the project without local dollars.
Yeah. Is that a required match for the state grant?
It was in the budget. Yeah. I mean, it's possible that we can do with a little less, you know, because we have one large pot of money that's, you know, and we have a commitment to a multi-county project. So there's a little bit of movement that can happen between counties, you know. If one house is purchased a little cheaper, we can shift a little bit of money. So that, you know, it's a little flexible that way, but we do need local commitments to be able to provide the houses.
Could you explain the application to the City of Vancouver versus the application to Clark County? Because it was originally a joint application. I think that's changed, correct?
Yeah, I mean, what I didn't understand when we put it in as a joint was that we needed to have to be fully funded by both. What we had really intended to do was to just maximize our chances of getting funding from somewhere in Clark County by, you know, getting funding either from the city or from the county. And, you know, it doesn't matter to the service provider whether the house is located in the city or the county. So we're flexible. One of the sources we would just need to have fund the project.
So you have a parallel application.
Yeah.
You know, basically an identical application also to the city of Vancouver, and it's going to be either or.
That's right.
Thank you.
The way that we've always worked joint applications is that the county and the city will match the amount that the other is putting in.
Yes.
So if you need a total of $45,000, we could both fund it at $22,500.
No.
You could. I mean, you know, and we do have people who are currently living in both the county and in the city. So we could bring clients from both places to be served in a house wherever the house was. So in fact, I mean, we need $45,000. I mean, it's sort of, you know, to us, if it's half and half, that's fine. Yeah.
So does it have to be considered a joint application?
No, it does not. You know, with a joint application comes, you know, along with the combined funding comes strings to location of the home or who it's served. So, well, both actually. Because we don't know, Foundation for a Challenge cannot know where the home is going to be, and it will probably be within Vancouver city limits. We don't know, you know, and where those they're going to serve are coming from. It was really hard for them to put together a joint application. So what they're doing is they have two identical applications for $45,000, not 90, you know, not 25, but $45,000. One with the county, one with the city of Vancouver, and whichever is selected, they're going to withdraw the other application. You know, they will not get both. That's as I understand.
Yeah, I mean, what I was told was when we applied for 45 for both was that we would need to have both fully funded, or else neither would fund it. So it seemed like it actually decreased our chances of, and we didn't really need the full 90. So that's why we did sort of competing proposals. But if both wanted to fund it at 22.5, that would I think be fine as well, and we would locate the house. But we bring people from both places into it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
So that makes sense. Yeah.
for someone, please? A county resident's a county resident, aren't they?
HUD cares
for
their funding.
So if we fund a house, it would have to be outside of Vancouver city limits, because once they're living in Vancouver, they're going to be Vancouver resident. So HUD cares. Vancouver gets their own HUD pot of money to be used within the city limits. We can't really.
So then, can you split? Because I assume Vancouver would care if the person lived outside the city limits.
That's what she was just saying, is they would bring county residents. They already have people that are living in the county. If they moved into the city, if they built the house in the city, we could fund that.
Yeah.
Or vice versa. We do joint projects a lot.
We'll call them imports. you can import
sure.
a person out of the county.
Sure.
And that qualifies.
Yeah.
We'd have to be careful about documenting that, how we do it.
Oh, my.
You know? Yes. When it comes to housing people, it's a little bit more complicated with joint applications than with service centers. You know, because the service center, you can really tell the residents of, you can tell the location, you can tell the residents of the population being served. You know, with housing, the resident is the location where
that's where they're moving. Yeah, they're less disabled if they're in the county, actually.
Oh my.
True. So basically, it's a 10, like you said, it's a 10% match, roughly 10% match locally.
Yeah.
Is that an FFC program requirement for the 10%? I'm still trying to nail that down. Or is that the granting agency's requirement for a 10% local match?
Well, it is what is necessary to afford to be able to buy and rehab the house, given the money that we have and the number of beds that we need to provide in several counties. So we need the cash
so
to make the project.
So it's FFC's kind of programmatic approach that if a county or a city brings some funding to the table, then you leverage these larger grants in that community. If a community doesn't bring that to the table, then you look to other communities that are able to do that.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's an issue for the competitiveness for the State Housing Trust Fund grant. So, I mean, I don't know that FFC, I mean, they would obviously love to get one source for every project. It would make it easier. But the state really wants to see participation from the local funding sources. So that's how we set up the budgets to compete for state funds. And then we have, we need X amount of dollars, so we have to raise them from the local funds.
So you scored a little higher, you got the grant because you showed the local money.
Right, because they always, when there are local dollars for every kind of project, they want to see those local dollars in, to make their money work harder.
And Vancouver Chamber of Commerce.
Good morning.
Morning.
I'm John McDonough. I'm currently the interim president CEO for the Greater Vancouver Chamber of Commerce. And this is Jeanette Santiago, who's our Small Business Resource Center consultant counsel. So, and we're here to talk with you this morning about a grant for the Small Business Resource Center, very different than some of the requests you're receiving. Ours is really focused on helping small business and entrepreneurs get themselves established in a way that they can quickly become sustainable. So we've had actually now a year of experience with the Small Business Assistance Program, and we believe it gives us the confidence to assist our clients and help them understand both the realities of what it is they think they want to do and see that they get directed to the appropriate resources to make that happen. So once they're on the right track, we think they have a much better chance at becoming one of the threads in the fabric of our economic vitality for the community. specifically by funding the grant that we've requested, you'll give us the opportunity to work with clients who, to date, we've had to turn away solely because of their location in the county. So we currently have a grant from the City of Vancouver that we've been working under, which restricts us to work only with those businesses and residents that live within the city. So this morning, in the next few minutes, I want to share some of the results we had in 2015 and talk about how 2016 has started and what we think we can do for Clark County. We've exceeded on most of the deliverables required through the city's grant, and we've done that through bringing to bear the resources of the Greater Vancouver Chamber of Commerce. So we've provided workshops for those who are interested in the program. We have an outreach activity. We use the communication tools of the chamber to advertise the program and have provided some scholarship opportunities for clients. We've interviewed, processed, and consulted with over 50 startup or existing businesses. Not all of those qualified for the program. And as a result, 28 clients were accepted into the program between February of last year and the end of the year. The majority of the businesses in the program consist of service-based or professional services. And 85% of those that we consulted with are starting out as home-based businesses. Jeanette has spent personally over 400 hours consulting with these clients through last year. Some of the programs, some of the services that we provide to their clients include advice and mentorship, feasibility of the business and assessment, bringing market research that's available to them so that they have a better picture of the market that they're trying to serve, access to community resources for personal and business needs. Some of the clients we've seen have needed credit repair work, that kind of thing. Financial business protection support, access to office space and computers. Those are at the chamber office. And access to additional community resources through the partners that the Greater Vancouver Chamber has assembled. I mentioned that we've provided classes and workshops for these clients, as well as some networking opportunities. So of the 28 clients that were actually accepted into the program last year, two have graduated, meaning that they no longer qualify for the services because they're in a sustainable situation. Seven businesses went from a pre-business status, really trying to figure out, they have an idea of the business they want to be in, but they really have no training or experience in terms of how to put that together. So from a pre-business status to a launch stage. And 10 businesses are continuing in the program in 2016 of the 28 that we enrolled last year. And the cross-section of businesses include service-based, retail, food industry, health and wellness, online sales, artists, and professional services. And so currently we have 13 businesses enrolled in the program, and for every business that we've enrolled, we've had to turn away three already. And of those, each of the three that we've turned away, two of those were based on location. So we really believe that there is an opportunity for Clark County to help some of these small businesses become established and contributing taxes to the local communities, and we believe we're well positioned to help make that happen. So with that, I think I'm dangerously close to my time, and I would answer any questions.
Maybe you said that, how long has this program been going on?
We started at the chamber in February of 2015.
And
so just a year ago.
How many businesses have went through it and say and have now have went through the program and now have an established business?
Well, the 28 were accepted, meaning through with the HUD, there were requirements and location. So three times as many were not, but you know, they were processed. But so right now we had from the last year, two graduated, meaning they're off on their own. Seven were pretty much went from, I have an idea that I thought of my, you know, in the shower yesterday, is this a good idea, to get them starting, meaning they have a business card, they have a website, they have an idea, they have a message, they have a product, a service, and they're selling. From seven of those, went from nothing to starting a business. And I forgot the other one, the 10. So those, and this is just the first year, and this is from February to December. Some of them, I didn't get them from February, some I got in the mid and
right.
summer. So they're all in different stages. And from those, 10 came over from last year to this year because they're either, you know, came later in the
Part of the challenge, I think, of the first year is just getting the word out to the businesses that the service is available.
So if it was a startup business that was outside of Vancouver, could they pay to participate?
No. I tell them, I said, I'm sorry, my time is really with this grant. There was two scenarios, couples, depending on the person. So if the chamber itself and their resources for the chamber can provide them the resources they need, you know, then I said, well, you can talk to my staff, my colleagues, and help you guide you through that process. Other resources we have, like SBDC, SBDC SCORE, then those are our partners. Also the Hispanic Chamber, because I know that they have other grants that take them, you know, that they can serve that particular client that I can't. So if I can't help them for whatever because of the eligibility, then I make sure that they don't walk away, you know.
Without any options.
Without any options, correct.
Well, I know that Kelly Love came out and pitched that to myself and several other people out in Richfield. So are you working with other cities, or is that that's just an idea?
The idea is to serve outside the city limits. Richfield, Camas, other. I went with Kelly to go see you guys, and the idea is to serve other communities, just like Richfield. Maybe you guys don't have the resources or the space. We can come in, serve your clients, and we'll just be working together.
And that's what part of this grant is.
Correct.
Yes.
And I have another question. Your workshop, what is your workshop, you know, small synopsis of what a workshop is and what's your attendance like?
Well, our attendance are there, for example, okay, so we also, there's workshops that we just have for this group, and then sometimes we invite other chamber members. The majority of the workshops are, for example, like credit repair, some of our partners come in and talk to our clients and say, okay, this is what we're about. Instead of them walk, sometimes it's easier just to have them come here to the chamber and tell them how they can help them. So those are well attended. There's bookkeeping and accounting. There is also selling. It's called Next Level Selling, so it's basically sales workshop. There is branding, more accounting, and there is a series that the chamber put on. It's called a workshop series. It was an 8-part. They brought in professionals from all over the community. They talked about branding. They talked about social media. They talked about legal. So they had 8 parts, and the chamber allowed all my clients in the program to go into the workshops at no cost. So all of these workshops are put in by the chamber, and there are no costs to the client, to the group, to my group.
Just
I would
to
say
make everyone aware we're at the 5-minute mark for questions right now.
Sure. And also just to let you guys know that the chamber puts as much of the funding that we're asking for, the chamber pretty much matches the funding.
How does this fit into the Wilmot income bracket? I mean, what you're, I guess what you're telling, you're serving clients that I assume qualify, is that, that
so
otherwise don't have the resources to?
Correct. So it's HUD 80% right now currently, which is about a family of four, $55,500 a year gross. So, you know, sometimes the one of the spouses doesn't work, and then the other does, and it takes them above, and that's something that we're
important. Can you talk about how your program is different from the Hispanic Chambers program? It wouldn't make sense to fund two duplicate programs, so I'm trying to understand.
Well, right now we share the Vancouver grant, so we have the same standards that we need to follow. We both serve 30 clients, they serve 30 clients with that. I don't know the other programs that they have in the Hispanic Chamber, but the one that we share is the Vancouver grant. And so what we want to do is take that same program and expand it out to outside the city limits.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Thank you very much for your time.
And next we have the Hispanic Chamber of Commerce.
For letting us be here this morning. I do have a handout for you, but I'm one of those people, I don't always follow the rules, including my rules. So I'm gonna, rather than start directly with the program, because you've heard a little bit about what the other chamber's doing, I'd like to speak briefly about who we are. The Hispanic Chamber is a nonprofit. We're a 501c3, unlike some chambers that are 501c6. I didn't introduce myself, I just jumped in. Yael Castillo, I'm the president of the Hispanic Chamber, and Jonathan Colon, who is our senior business development coordinator with us for over 12 years, and I'm one of the founding members of the chamber. So I'll talk briefly about us and then talk about the program. I know we only have 5 minutes. So we are a nonprofit. And the difference between a 501c6 and a 501c3, the C6 is more focused on serving the benefit of its members. 501c3s are, like us, nonprofit, who are more concerned about the total community. Our mission is to work with all members of the community to support the advancement of Latinos in Oregon and Southwest Washington. We've been around for 22 years. We have served Southwest Washington for 22 years in our areas of program, which include our business development, which I'll talk about, technical assistance, scholarships. We've given almost $2 million, $1.8 million in scholarships to students, again, in Southwest Washington as well as Oregon, and those have been matched by colleges and universities, so it doubles the impact. And then we also have a year-long Latino leadership program. The idea is to build capacity. The whole thing is to build capacity and move people up. In addition, we do other things working with public policy individuals such as yourself. So let me just talk a little bit about the program itself. Like was mentioned, we are also conducting a program similar to what we're proposing in Vancouver. Just for your information, we have over 14 years working with technical assistance programs and 12 years working with CDBG dollars. We currently have funds that we work with through the City of Portland. Also, we have funds that we work with through the city of Beaverton, and currently through the city of Vancouver. Like the other chamber, the reason that we've approached you is this will allow us to expand our service area, allow us to serve those people that we have had. We don't turn people away. We have not been able to enroll them in Vancouver. In addition to, like the chamber, we're proposing to match this program by 50%. So $100,000 on the table, $50,000 that we bring in. What we have found with CDBG dollars, it enables us to pay for a portion of the real cost of providing the program. It does not provide all the costs. So as a result, the Hispanic Chamber looks for other sources to help subsidize the programs that we provide, including this one, the CDBG. In our case, in Vancouver, we have the city funds in Vancouver. We have a three-year grant from the Northwest Health Foundation for the Kaiser Permanente Community Fund. And then more recently, we were funded by the Community Foundation of Southwest Washington. And then, of course, our own fundraising that we do, that we put money on the table to subsidize our programs. So we feel that we are providing services, but we're also providing resources. Thank you. Okay. So what we're proposing is to provide technical one-on-one. Our focus is one-on-one because developing the relationship with those individuals is critical. These are people who've never accessed business development services. They're at the poverty level. They have a tremendous amount of need, so we focus on one-on-one. We're also proposing a bilingual, bicultural approach. It doesn't mean that we don't serve non-Latinos. It just means that we have the capacity to serve a broader group of people. Our goal is to lift their skills in terms of being able to manage their either a new business or an expanding business. The goal is to increase revenues. We're proposing to serve 60 small businesses. You can see the registrations. I'll jump to benefits. That these are individuals who've never, ever been served before. Poor people who don't have the capacity to access resources. And in the case of Latinos, people who have not had access to explain their situation in their own language and in their own culture. We are helping them develop skills that they will use a lifetime, such as financial management skills, life skills. And the goal is to move them out of poverty and help them learn, develop long-term wealth. So with that, I'll stop. Thank you very much. You were very kind. Questions?
I guess I wanted a little bit of clarification. You said that you would serve anyone.
Yes.
So it's not exclusively for the Hispanic population.
That's correct. We don't turn anyone away. Anyone, we've served white males, white females, African Americans, African immigrants, Asian Americans, Asian immigrants, again, anyone. Because we're bringing to the table additional resources, that gives us flexibility in being able to serve anyone that needs to be served. Also, there's no time limit. We have people, Jonathan has people that he has served over 22 years that maybe started their business 22 years ago, and now they're building, and they're, as you can imagine, their concerns, their problems, their needs are more complex. So we stay with people over the years. We have examples of people who went from zero who are now $3 million businesses, but their bonding needs, their insurance needs, their all of these things are more complex.
I think the dynamic for the, and thank you for having us, I think the dynamic for our program is the long-term investment in the client and being there to make that growth. You know, business is like a ladder. Every time you take a step, it's just a whole different world. And our objective is to just be there through those phases. It's usually we have banking partners that I always say it's more important to be there when they get the money and ensure that they spend it correctly than to get them. We just don't do formation. There's a lot of programs out there that support formation. They're fantastic. They're great partners. But you have to go beyond formation. Once you get your license, your permit, and all that stuff, and you comply, then what? What do we do now? How do you work with your situation at home and in your community and the things that your children are going through to get you and maintain you focused on your objectives for your business? Financial literacy is a very important component of what we do. Usually you come in, and if you can't do a household budget, there's really not much we can do. So we start working with them to get that household budget because that's going to tell us how much they need to earn and then what fields and what industries and what sections of that industry are appropriate at that time so that they can actually track and manage their growth over a long time. And Gail, I'm sorry, this is probably the last time I do this. I usually use a medical analogy. We're primary care doctors. There's four of us that practice primary care, right? But people come into our office and we actually just do triage. And we said, go to your primary care doctor, right? That's what normally happens when you end up in the emergency room to the triage. After the triage, as primary care doctors, we do actually call. We don't wait for them to call back. And then start working on those things that will actually create a more holistic, long-term health for that individual, that business. So it's that two-pronged approach, right? And you go to the doctor once, but you still have to go for checkups. And that's your long-term relationship. I've been around this, and Gail said 22 years. I've been 13, just because I don't want to be that old.
I'm that old.
what I would say is I and the other three business development members, our commitment is to be there for the consequences of our advice and our coaching and our mentoring. And that's sort of the core value of our organization, to be there for the consequences, whether positive or negative, to redirect or restart or re-energize small businesses.
One thing I'll add is that, again, we're comprehensive, so usually sometimes the clients will come in with families, and if we see teenagers there, then we also approach the scholarship. Are you going to school? What are your plans? Did you know we have a scholarship? We have workshops, and then you can apply not just for our scholarships, for other scholarships, et cetera. So we look at the family unit as well and their other needs.
Will the CDBG funds add another staff person or just
yes.
go to pay the current staff?
No. We would need to, our people are full.
Yeah.
So I would need to hire an additional person that would work primarily on this. Jonathan would be responsible for the training and the oversight based on his experience, but we would make sure. And one of the things, just so you know, and you can talk to the City of Vancouver, I think that they would agree and that we have brought our experience to the table in terms of how to manage the CDBG funds, how to make sure we're meeting the federal guidelines, how to collect the data, because we have a database, how to collect the data so that you can report it back to your funders, and just total financial accountability. As I mentioned, I think on the handout, we are audited. We're by an outside CPA firm. That allows me to sleep at night. It will allow you to sleep at night to know that the funds are going and being used as they are meant to be.
And we're at the 4 minute, just past the 4 minute mark for questions. Is that why?
Any other questions you'd like, sir?
Is there a duplicity then, or do you work with the chamber, a Vancouver chamber?
We have worked with the chamber.
There was something that was.
We have worked with the chamber, but as was mentioned, sometimes we will make a referral to them for some service, or vice versa. They'll make a referral to us if someone doesn't meet the guidelines. Again. We have more flexibility and are able to serve them whether or not they meet the CDBG guidelines or not, and we'll deal with them long term. But, you know, there's such an amount of need. The resources, as you know, are limited.
So the Vancouver office this year, just for the calendar year, which is their pilot year, served 145 small businesses. 45 of those were outside the city of Vancouver. Out of the 100, about 68 actually qualified for the medium income requirements of the program. And I would say that we have about six brick and mortar places that were open. And I would say that we've done two large national contracts.
Yeah.
For the Ross, and what was the other one, Will? Will Suarez is our business development. And that was, and that's actually an individual who's 80% MFI, which means not only did you get them there, we're in business with them. So it just takes a lot of time. I mean, I think the tenacity and the want to be successful is there, but once you get it all, then you got all the other real life stuff that you have to deal with, all those systems, and you're asking them to, at a hyper speed, put in all these business systems, understand them, and then make them work. And I think that's one of the things that helps, is that we have a sort of a broader approach, just because we've been doing a little bit longer, 13 years, and we also have a large membership base that we can call. You know, we had lawyers on the phone giving us pro bono. We had corporate procurement people giving us some support around how to make these bids. We had the insurance industry giving us some pointers on, and this is all pro bono that's being leveraged through our 850 members that we have. Because we are four, and I'll be really quick, we have four business development coordinator. On the other side of the river, people are showing up on that side as well for that market. They're looking at Oregon as a market, so we're serving on that side those individuals from this side that are looking at Oregon as a market.
We're done.
Thank you. This feels like speed dating, guys.
Thank you.
Thanks
for being understanding, too. And Proud Ground is next.
Good morning. Most of you are pretty familiar with us by now, but I did put together a brief PowerPoint to explain our proposal and a little bit about our program, and then we can leave a lot of time for questions. Let's see. Oh, our account doesn't transfer. This is a brief summary of our proposal, and apologies, looks like it's cut off a little bit. We're requesting $195,000, to which we would add at least an additional $30,000 of funding, plus homeowners would contribute private mortgage funds of about $160,000 per home. That would allow us to add three more permanently affordable homes to Clark County. Oops. Sorry about that. Wow. Is it going on its own?
It is.
It's going fast.
I think it's going on its own. Not touching the budget. Sorry about that. What we do is there'd be about $60,000 of subsidy in each home. The remaining funds, $8,000, cover our transaction fees, which covers all of our staff time to provide home buyer education and counseling, to manage the real estate transaction, and then, as many of you know, we also provide post-purchase support to all of our homeowners. The education and counseling we provide is very key to the community allowance model of homeownership. It's one of the reasons that Proud Ground has not lost any homes to foreclosure, and it's another reason that nationally, when the foreclosure crisis was at its height at about 10%, the community land trust model of homeownership had a foreclosure rate of less than 0.5%. So we're always there. We work a lot with buyers as they're getting ready to get mortgage ready, as they're shopping, and then once they're homeowners. This is some information just about, as you all know, we're in a housing crisis. It's not a secret. And this is, yeah.
Just back up.
Oops. I don't know what I'm doing.
There you go.
Thank you. Sorry, I won't touch it. this isn't news to us, but you know, we've had some research commissioned recently that will soon be released, but this is really puts it in some pretty stark numbers as to why we're having a housing crisis. Wages aren't moving, housing prices are soaring. And it's across the board, rental and homeownership. And need for everything across the board. Our specific program, of course, is home ownership. And why? Home ownership provides, of course, stability, but it also provides opportunity. I swear I'm not touching the button. Look. So, one of the questions people ask about our model of homeownership, since it is shared equity, which means if somebody decides to sell, they they share any appreciation with the home with the next buyer. So does that contribute to wealth building? And it does. What we have found through researching our model and the tools that we use is that after at least 10 years of home ownership, a Proud Ground homeowner, if they sold, would walk away with at least $60,000 in equity. That's significant. And of course, that number is nothing if you're renting. And that is enough in this market for a down payment on a market rate home, which is typically what happens with Proud Ground lease sales. And so to give you an idea of how homes are kept affordable, our median resale price over the past 15 years, we've had about 50 homes resell, is $130,000. So that shows you how it works, is that homes are affordable initially and they're affordable resale upon resale, which is key because one home will then serve many families. Your investment serves many families over time. And again, we all know a lot of these things from national data about the benefits of homeownership. Kids do better at school, health outcomes are stronger, employment outcomes are better. But we did some local research and we surveyed our homeowners and then used some regional data as well to just really kind of supplement those national statistics. So who do we serve? People with, we serve them. steady jobs, stable incomes, folks who can qualify for a home loan, just not one at market rate. You know, our typical homeowner, So these are our current Clark County homeowners. We have three of them from our 1450 award. Gives you an idea of what they do. And here you go. They're at 72% MFI is the median household income for the folks that we're currently serving, $48,000 a year. And with our 1516 award, this is the update. We had, again, enough money, particularly when we brought some of our own, to serve three households. One person is under contract for the home, one person has submitted an offer, and one family is house hunting. Questions?
So if I'm a homeowner with you, my mortgage is through Bank of America.
It's through Umpqua Bank or Home Street Bank, but yes.
Okay, it's through one of those.
Mm-hmm.
And then am I with you for the rest of my homeownership, or at some point am I moving on, or...
It depends.
How long do you stay with me?
As long as you stay in that home you bought through Proud Ground, we're there. If you decide to sell that home and move on to either a market rate home or elsewhere, then you leave us.
So if I'm floundering, what,
oh,
what do I
so
get?
Okay. Ongoing post-purchase support. So there's a couple of ways that we do that. We collect a monthly service fee from folks of about $45 a month. That helps, covers our costs, but also what that does is give us an indicator of how people are doing. So if you stop paying that fee, we will proactively reach out to you to find out what's going on. We also have access to the status of your home loan, so we'll get a notice if you're in default or if you're behind. And again, we will proactively reach out to you. We will work with you and act as your advocate with your lender to see if you need a payment plan or a workout. If something's happened and you just been selling is the best option, then we help you do that as well. And we do that with any private rent homeowner who wants to sell. We manage all aspects of the resale process. We have a wait list regionally of about 300 households. We're working to build a wait list in Clark County, so when the time comes that folks sell, we market those homes to other income-ready first-time home buyers.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. That it?
Well, thank you.
Thank you. I brought some copies of the PowerPoint, particularly since that was a little. And I apologize, I only had a couple of cards. So if anybody has any questions or would like more information, please don't hesitate to contact me. So if you're trying to get a hold of me, can I just give you some?
Sure.
Yeah. Thank you. All right. Thank you all very much.
And Salvation Army is next.
Okay, I have some materials. I will can I just start on each side?
Should
be more than enough.
Yep, it looks like it.
Thank you.
So in the materials that you're getting, the top sheet is a case statement that is a nice summary of the project we've applied for funding for. And the balance of the material is simply a copy of the presentation you're seeing, so you can take it with you and review it as you choose. So, all right. And is it the this one?
The arrow right here.
The arrow.
There you go.
Okay. Oh, okay. All right. So, well, good morning, first of all. I'm Steve Rusk. I'm the development director for the local Salvation Army here in Clark County, and it has been an honor for me to work alongside some of the most dedicated people in the world at the Salvation Army for the last 29 years. Nearly half of my life has been spent with this organization. So it's truly a privilege to be here. Thank you so much for taking your time to listen to this most worthy cause. So, of course, you know a little bit about the Salvation Army. It is a household word. Looks like... Okay, all right. So... I want to start right away with talking about the local impact of the Salvation Army. And the Army serves over 12,000 households a year, representing over 35,000 individuals. And it's no small thing that 46% of those are dependent children. And that just gives you a little sense of what we're about. What we're up to. Now, specifically, we are planning to build a community center on the east side of Vancouver. This is just a aerial view of where our property is. We have over 4 acres that we've purchased over time. We will be consolidating our services from 2 locations where we've had separate operations for over 30 years. And by doing that, we will save time and energy in the delivery of services, as well as a better way to meet the needs of those that come to us. Now, the community center is much more than a building. A building it is, and we plan to construct at least a 15,000 square foot facility. But the important thing is what's going to go on inside the building. So much of this we're doing in one way or another. We are providing a shopping-style food pantry with dignity of service to the individuals and also opportunities for volunteers to serve one-on-one. We will implement a demonstration kitchen for instruction to those who to help those who come to us for food to prepare nutritious meals for themselves and their children. Computer lab will be created for children and adults in to help with resourcing and education. We will have an expansion of our most recent and growing program, our Say Club after school program, will grow from a capacity of 30 to 60. We will create a drop-in center for senior meals and social activities. And we will have a disaster services, dedicated space for disaster services, which is something that we're called upon to do whenever there is a natural disaster. Now, let me just get real quick here to the progress. I am thrilled to tell you that without any public demonstration of this project, we have worked behind the scenes to raise 52% of our goal to date. And so we have, from the following sources, $1.2 million committed from the state of Washington through a legislative member request. We have $1.3 million from Salvation Army reserves that we've accumulated over time. And then nearly $600,000 committed from individual donors. The most recent and noteworthy gift, perhaps, is a challenge gift from the All of Us for $500,000 that came in within the last 2 weeks. So we do have some people who believe in the project, and so we have a challenge now of raising $2.7 million. We hope that we're successful in securing CDBG funds. Thank you very much for giving your consideration. We're applying to both the county and the city. We have an interest in applying for $750,000 in foundation grants, and then the remainder balance will be an at-large community campaign to meet our goal of $5.8 million. With that, questions?
Yes, sir. For those of us that live 25 miles away from this site,
yeah,
or more, what's the benefit to all of us in the North County, in Yackel, and Madison, in Richfield, and Woodland, in the center? Well, I mean, you are offering after-school care. Of course, that's not going to happen.
Right.
How does that benefit the half of the county that lives north of Highway 500?
Well, that's a good question. It sets me back, doesn't it? So here's what our service area is all of Clark County. So there are people who come to us from all over Clark County and receive services, particularly for prevention services. So we provide financial aid to families in all of the jurisdictions in the county. We do have a unit operating with all the basic services in Washougal, so we have an established work there. So that's another option for people to go to. My dream of this facility is to have both a place to work from and a place to come to. And so I have worked long and hard in the planning process of becoming more mobile with our services. And we hope that one of the things that will help us to do that is our emergency canteen that will be stored on site, not just for disaster services, but also to go out into the community to provide a connection for people who may be in remote areas of the county.
Is there bus service there?
Pardon?
Is there a bus service nearby?
So there is a bus service nearby on 112th. Unfortunately, a few years ago, C-Tran canceled the bus that stopped in front of us. But we hope that we have good faith that they will consider re-implementing.
You mean the new site?
The
because,
new site.
Well, if there's nothing there now, I can understand why they wouldn't stop there. But there's no building, correct?
No. Our church and administration offices are there, but their ridership was too low to support a stop in front of the place. Okay. And so we hope that's a part
by.
Of the plan.
It does come by.
Yes.
I was just going to say that we asked them to analyze their service, people who are being served for the split. And so they requested $147,000 from Vancouver and $153,000 from the county, which means already the people that they're serving is a little more than 50% county residents. Maybe not North County residents.
I mean, I can appreciate, and the reason I think that's a really good question, because it's a broad area, and I appreciate the distance that people have to travel. I mean, we're we're offering services, yeah, you know, we can schedule an appointment for you to come in, but then there's the transportation. Yes?
So if you don't, if after all the fundraising you're short or whatever, is there a plan in place to maybe reduce the size of the building?
We are working. What I'm learning is called value engineering. So we are working with the architect in various considerations of these models. The important thing is that we're able to offer all the services that we've outlined. And that we're committed to.
Other questions?
You did fine, Mark.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you. So it's 9:56. Let's do a 10-minute break and start. You're at 10:06. Sorry, Reach. We're going to see you.
Sunshine.
I see the sign. Yeah.
Yeah, 1 minute sign, and then we'll again to
wrap up.
And I'm not going to be like, eh. So if you need coffee or anything like that, let's get it.
Development. Thanks for having us today. I'm going to be very brief and then pass it to Ben. So most of you are probably familiar with REACH. Thanks for your past support. REACH was founded in 1982 in Southeast Portland. We developed and self-managed now just over 2,000 units of affordable housing. So affordable housing is our focus. Also a small home repair program in Portland. Of course, our work in Clark County goes back a ways in the form of ACE, Affordable Community Environments, known as ACE. We joined forces, ACE and REACH, in 2013 and have been working now under the name REACH. But there are 195 units of housing already. That's the ACE portfolio that is in Orchards area, it's in Washougal, it's in Fruit Valley. So we're spread across the county. We're really excited about our this project, Isabella Court, which you're going to hear about phase two. Phase one is underway and starting to come out of the ground. So again, thanks for having us today. I will now turn it over to Ben Sturtz, who is our project manager, who's been working on the Isabella Court project for the past year and a half.
Got it.
And got a little delayed by the weather, but it is now underway, so we're really excited.
All right. Thank you, Dan.
Yep.
So the same project team is who we're looking at on this phase two of Isabella Court, using local team construction, who we're really working diligently through this weather issues on phase one. MWA Architects, our development consultant and owner's representative is Housing Development Center. We're really looking for most aspects of this project at the same 49 units, 46 one-bedrooms and 3 two-bedrooms. The site has now been through a short approval process with the city, so it's now owned by an LLC that we will then work with to acquire the land at some later date. And really, the focus here is energy-efficient apartments for seniors, real close to amenities and transit. That's the rendering of Isabella Court that we will take and kind of just bookend the site with this phase two project. I mentioned the unit mix thus far. We're near two different vine stops along Fourth Plain, which is less than a block south of the site. 62nd Avenue is really the north-south avenue that the project's off of. We're projecting that community gardens on phase one, we would do the same thing on phase two. We know that's something that seniors really view as an amenity, and there would be a community room on both phases. Part of the reason of the project, though, is really the need in this county. As many of you know, quite a bit of folks in this county are cost burdened, and so we see rising rents, obviously, Vancouver having one of the largest rent increases in the nation in the past year. The focus here on Clark County households is the fact that 916 households are paying more than 30% of their income towards rent, and 637 households in the county are paying over 50% of their income towards rent. So 30% threshold, they are cost burdened, but there's obviously over 600 households that are severely cost burdened in the county that we really feel like this project would address. One of the other issues on need is just the fact that you know, folks in Clark County over the age of 60 is expected to decrease over 44% between 2010 and 2020. That's well over the 12% growth rate for the population as a whole. And then the fact that there's just a limited supply. There are 6 existing rent-restricted properties for seniors totaling 588 units in the Central Vancouver area, an additional 11 properties totaling 544 units in the rest of the county, and just not enough to really address the need at this point in time. Our solution is to project at least 20 units at 30% of AMI and below, 29 of the 49 units at 50% AMI and below, and you can see the rent range as a result of those particular targets. Our location is centrally located between I-5 and 205, just north of 4th Plain. Like I said, really close to some vine stops. This neighborhood is actually going through quite a bit of redevelopment now. You can see along 4th Plain, there's quite a bit of streetscape improvements, and there's been some intersection improvements, so we really feel like there's some real investment being put into the property and the area right now. Talked about transit between the 57th Avenue and the 60th Avenue, vine stops, so it really provides some great transit access for low-income households. This is the southern portion of the site that we're waiting to develop now. We're about 10% through construction on phase one after we started construction just over a month and a half ago. And that's why we really say, why now? Well, we have site control, we own the site now. So for us to mobilize after a month of finishing construction, up with the same team and the same design, we really feels like this would be a great opportunity for us in 2016 to get funds from the Clark County, to get funds from the city and the state, so that in 2017 we can go forward with a 9% low-income housing tax credit application, and with all those financing sources together, start construction, because we know the challenge is there right now. And we could leverage in doing that over $10 million to really make this possible while things are going on at the site already. So with that, without further ado, we'd love to hear any questions you may have.
What is this? What are you going to use this money for?
Construction.
Just simply construction. How much is the total bill?
So we have about a $7.4 million construction contract on this particular phase. It's about $400,000 more than we're doing on phase one, only because between now and 2017, we have to have an estimated contingency, not knowing where subcontractor pricing is at. So that's essentially what the total bill is. On phase one, we use the Clark County funds for construction as well. I feel it's a really good use. It's an eligible use more than anything.
Maybe you can talk about the services that you provide ongoing on site. You already did a little bit, but elaborate.
You want to talk a little bit about that?
Sure, yeah. Obviously the affordable housing by itself is a critical thing. It's locked in, it's affordable forever. I mean, REACH's mission is to keep it affordable forever beyond the tax credit requirements. And then in terms of services, right, we have resident services on site, so staff that everything from kind of emergency assistance and helping connect people to support if they have a crisis, but also we have financial capability classes that we do, helping people save. We have a match savings program so people can save money, both for adults and for young people. Our sites with families have after-school programs and tutoring clubs. Since this will be a senior project, it'll be our first senior development in Clark County, but we have other senior housing in our portfolio. And so in those sites, we have resident service staff that do activities in the building with seniors to create a sense of community. But then also we bring in partners. So in downtown Portland right now, for example, working with the network of health providers, and they actually have health navigators who come on site and help people, if they're not accessing the healthcare, figure out how they can communicate and get plugged into their healthcare better. So we would envision having similar partnerships on this project when it opens, and that's an important part of what we do, making sure it's not just an apartment but has service connections.
We also hired a consultant to analyze the project like we do every year. If you might remember Fred Dahlweiler, he provided a report and a little summary.
Sure. So you all will get a report from me that's both a narrative, but I also do Excel spreadsheets so you can see sort of the breakdown. So I think they did a great job summarizing this. Obviously, the second phase of this will be nice if the funds are allocated so that they can leverage that. And obviously, both the county and the city home funds obviously show local need for the project, which helps for their tax credit application next year. So I think the three areas that I'll touch on quickly, since they did a nice job summarizing, first of all, the funding. So there's really four funding sources. There's the county home funds that they're applying for, the city home funds. They'll have a tax credit application in 2017, which will generate, by their numbers, about $10.2 million of equity towards this project. And I would concur, based upon my own calculations and looking at basis and where credit prices are, that's probably a realistic number. They're also applying, have you guys done the stage one funding application yet?
No.
So that's coming.
Right.
So there's another $2 million in housing trust fund from the state of Washington, which you guys were successful in the first phase. I would assume, given affordable senior development for the second phase, that they'll most likely be successful in that. That's obviously a critical element, because if you've got a total cost of roughly $12.8 million, $2 million, that's the housing trust fund money. So that's one aspect. The second aspect I want to talk about is the cost. So I just mentioned $12.8 million in total cost, which builds into some contingency, because right now what we're seeing, and in my involvement in other areas of commercial real estate, it's really tough to get contractors. So they've built about $700,000 plus in contingency for their hard cost contract next year, which I think is probably probably realistic if things continue the way they are. The one thing I will tell you that the total cost of about $260,000 a unit is a pretty stout number, but they have to use data staking wages and some other things which obviously inflate that number. And I will tell you that based on that number, it probably just barely exceeds what the Washington state, you know, they're looking for tax credits, that exceeds their total per cost number. However, you can get a waiver, and I think you did that on the first phase as well. So I don't think that that's necessarily a concern for a four-story elevator building. The last thing that I would touch on is, you know, looking at their operating pro forma, I think it's very reasonable. I'm sure you're basing it on some of your experience and your other senior projects in your portfolio. But what we talked about a little bit before we came in here is the fact that there may be some excess cash flow. So when you look at the pro forma that I'm presenting, you know, one of the things I think that's always helpful is to be able to recycle these home funds, and especially if you get the 8 vouchers from the city, which will give them an added rent bump because instead of tenants paying 30% of their income, they'll get fair market value from the Section 8 vouchers, that will help and hopefully allow them to be able to recycle these home funds instead of treating it sort of as a grant that they pay interest on. So, you know, again, you'll get a fairly detailed report from me, and I have to look at different kind of funding regs and that kind of stuff, so you'll see all that. I'm happy to, as you can see, I've obviously been through the project, but I'm happy to answer any questions now. Yeah, just over.
I'll just quickly add that an RFP, a request for proposals for those vouchers, usually comes up in the summertime, at least it did last year from the Vancouver Housing Authority, so we'll pursue that when it becomes available. The stage one application of the state for the housing trust funds just got released within the last week and a half, so we're working through that. It's due March 1st, and then there'll be a stage two application that will apply for those $2 million around July. And in discussions with the state, we were up in Olympia last week just talking to them. There's actually National Housing Trust Fund dollars that they're going to be funneling to. Those are specifically for 30% units, and as you can see, we have 20 units at 30% AMI and below, so we'll probably pursue National Housing Trust Fund dollars.
And one thing for new board members, or just a reminder to everybody, is HUD sets aside 15% of our home funds of each annual allocation that can only be awarded to Community Housing Development Organization, and reaches our only, they're called CHOTOs, it reaches our only CHOTO that has applied this year. So that little portion of the funds couldn't go to just a regular nonprofit.
How much is that?
15% of
$300,000.
We'll have the numbers at the next March meeting.
And if you don't use it, you lose it.
We can hold it over until the next year, but eventually, if we didn't use it, we'll go back to that.
Do thank you for your time and your support of this project in the past. So, it's a great day.
Thank you.
Thank you. And Community Services Northwest is next.
Center. So we get all of our referrals from the Housing Solutions Center. Participants once entered into our program received case management from Community Services Northwest and then the rent assistance from these home funds. They're able to move into the housing of their choice. And to achieve this, we use scattered sites around Clark County and with private landlords. And that it doesn't have to be within just Vancouver. It can be in Washougal, Battleground, anywhere around, as long as it fits within the rent requirements. This year, we're pretty excited because we're partnering with Clearview Employment Services. It's called the Hope Change Employment Navigator Support System. And it's for supportive employment for those who come in and are looking for to increase employment or increase income. And they have other barriers that they just fit, probably wouldn't fit with, like the regular going down to an employment office. We'll continue to help people apply for through SOAR or Social Security Disability or just regular it could be SSI or SSDI. So this program has been going since about 2011 with the help of the Home Funds. And we are not requesting case management money. We were able to do the case management piece on our own. So last year, we used three different programs to provide the case management. We used PCAP, PATH, and our Medicaid outpatient billing. So we're pretty resourceful when it comes to figuring out the case management piece. And then last year, we were also able to serve about almost 20 people. So it's quite a few people that get served. This time, we have about 16 people in our program. I wanted to share a little case study because it's all about the people. So Justin was referred to the CHECK program. As he was exiting a system of care, he had been unstable with his mental health and for quite a long time, and he'd gone into an adult residential facility in December 2014. He came out into the CHECK program, and he was able to get CHECK case management, and he also got into therapy at that same time and stayed in therapy. He's gone to therapy. He started off going once a week, and he also has found stable housing with the help of the case manager. He's doing so well. He's found a job. He's found kind of like the apartment of what he calls his dreams, and he now only needs to see a mental health counselor once a week, but he's still increasing his hours at work. He's also working on his mental health and his physical health. So we see like these kinds of situations frequently. I thank you guys for your consideration for the continuation of these funds to help interrupt the cycle that is it's a challenging cycle to interrupt when people are going into systems of care and back into homelessness. It's great to catch them before they go back into homelessness. And with your guys' help, it's really hard for us to get people to have great success in mental health and substance abuse treatment without a house. They need a home to be in. I know that for you guys it's hard to keep people in, you know, like to have that other side of the success when people are housed but they don't have the mental health and the substance abuse treatment. So together I feel like this is a great collaboration, and we appreciate the opportunity to continue this program, and so do the people who have participated. Thank you. Any questions?
So where are you located, and besides other institutions or referring people to you, how would someone reach out to you or find out about the services you offer?
So we have a few different locations, but since all of the referrals come in through Housing Solutions Center, that's kind of the coordinated entry point. So that's how people find out about housing services. When they want to know about mental health services, they can we're in that network, I guess. Okay. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
What's the length of service or treatment that you have with the individuals?
So for the CHECK program, it's a maximum of 24 months in the program. We try to shoot for shorter so that we can serve more people, though.
What's typical?
I would say a year is pretty typical.
And the success rate on this?
So, like, at the end, I don't have, like, a hard number.
Sure. I'm sure it's a moving target.
It just depends on kind of, like, what's going on with the people. Sometimes people go back into treatment, but sometimes they stay stable in housing for a long period of time, but that's usually, it's a challenging group to work with, but it's like, well, worth it, because in the end, we do see that progress and people staying in their housing and getting jobs, and that's why we are partnering with the Hope Change, so that we can help more people increase their income.
Does that also follow with your rental assistance?
So the rental assistance comes from from this side, the home funds.
Yes.
That's the part that that it's like more challenging for us to find the money for that. So in case management services, I think that we estimated it would be around almost $80,000 with everything combined, like case management, treatment that we're putting in for our side of things. So it's it's kind of hard to capture on a report, but it's like easier to think about how much treatment have they been in, and when you look at down the road, like how many services they were accessing just in our agency, it's bigger than just the little case management piece that we're doing once a month, or if that makes sense.
You talk about that you're able to go to about, you would hope to be able to go to about 90 clients, so what are you at now? What do you normally service?
So we hope to have, I think really like we would like to serve about 25 clients a year. So right now we're around 20 that's what we made in 2015. So 2016, right now we have 16 people in the program, but we could have some of those will transition out, and then we'll transition new people in.
Okay, thank you.
So 20 to 25 people. Any other questions?
Thank you.
So we've allocated a little longer time for the next couple presentations because they're combined. And next is Janice Booth. And it's combining the services with the rental assistance.
Hello, everyone. I think we'll sit. We don't need to stand because we don't have a PowerPoint. Going old school. I'm Scott Conger. I'm a housing director, Clark County, Janice Youth. It's Dennis Morrow, he's our executive director.
I'm just getting our PowerPoint. I don't know how Micros things work, so we have to.
Old school. So today we're requesting funds for case management and rental assistance for the NEST program. The NEST program is a rapid rehousing program that assists individuals off the streets and into their own apartments. Dennis asked me to pull some numbers of what we've done over the last 7 years since we've been in Clark County. And over the last 7 years, we've assisted 473 individuals in obtaining and maintaining housing. Of those 473, over 430 of them are still stably housed and self-sufficient. So currently we have a rapid rehousing program, and these funds are more of a transitional housing program. And the requested funds are for individuals that we serve through our drop-in center and our outreach program that have higher barriers, higher needs, more vulnerable on the streets and require more time to become self-sufficient. So we are looking for up to a year to 2 years to serve these individuals with intensive case management. We found that housing first isn't necessarily the best fit with homeless youth. So what we call Housing Plus, which is intensive case management, helping them obtain housing, setting goals, obtaining those goals. When we serve you, I think the part of the reason for our success rate so high, over 90%, is because when we catch youth earlier, before they're on the streets for a long time, and they don't develop such high needs in the mental health. When you're on the streets for a long time, you develop coping mechanisms through the use of drugs and alcohol. Mental health problems arise. If we can catch them early and serve these youth and, I guess, address those needs, the immediate needs by housing them, the success rate rises much more quickly. We utilize our outreach team, the Yellow Brick Road Program, to compass all of Clark County to find these high needs youth. We have a drop-in center, the Perch, where these youth can come take a shower and get food, do some laundry. And those youth that are at the Perch, we've noticed over the last 4 years, some of them weren't getting housed and they would graduate into the adult system. So with this program, we've developed a referral system where the perch and Yellow Brick Road can make referrals to the Housing Solutions Center, so we can catch these youth before they get into the adult system, graduate into the adult system, so we can address those needs and minimize the cost of the community. So with that said, I'll turn it over to Dennis for a little bit.
Just one other question. So how many of the youth you work with, many of them have also families, like little kids?
Oh, yeah. The majority of youth that we work with do have children.
So we're talking homeless youth, but we're talking homeless youth with kids, and the kids are typically underage, more than one, under age five.
And a lot of it is getting the youth, the children out of foster care by housing the youth so we can get them out of foster care and reunited with their parental figures.
So this is just
this is kids with kids.
Yes.
Yes, that's 18 to 25.
Saying, their own kids.
Yes.
Yes. All right. The majority of them have children.
Not a family that they're in.
No.
A family they are of.
Correct.
Right. Yeah. I was reviewing statistics last year, just before we were sending them in for a report, and I called him up and I said, something's wrong here. You've got twice as many people you're working with as we said we were going to work with. And he goes, no, those are all kids. We just identify the youth we're working with, but the majority of people are now these children. So just a short form, this is just a quick schematic of the homeless youth system in Clark County. And we are the homeless youth system in Clark County. Janus is the only organization in this county that specifically targets and works with these youth, starting with street outreach to the drop-in to the different homeless programs. But also you'll see part of his art form is connecting these youth to a wide variety of community services. I want to just have you think about not homeless youth, think about these as familyless children. Any of you who have children, imagine if they were 14 or 15 years old and found themselves on the street. These are children who didn't choose to be homeless, who came from families where there was high levels of drug abuse, high levels of physical violence, high levels of sexual abuse. They're escaping to safety, but now they're on the streets. And I think sometimes we think they're young adults and they're not. The goal of the program, the national goal, is to end youth homelessness by 2020. That's what HUD is now setting as a national goal. This is the only program in this county that actually will help end youth homelessness because it's the only one that's targeting this group. This is only a down payment, but the way we look at it is we're trying to push youth through this funnel, and the down payment looks like this. Most youth are parents, so if we can get them housed and over 90% of the people he's working with remain housed, those are little kids that are not going to be homeless. And that's one way you end youth homelessness. The other way you end it is you look at this. Every youth that we serve, conservative, and I did a very, very, very conservative estimate, every homeless youth that does not graduate into adult homelessness is a minimum of $1 million of lifetime services that the community no longer has to pay. So it's a major step that ends youth homelessness. If we end youth homelessness, hopefully that reduces our adult homeless population. But it's just done one life at a time. Janus has programs. We're the largest provider of services for runaway and homeless youth in the entire northwestern region because of work that we do in Portland as well. And I can tell you, in working with a network of agencies throughout the country, there is not a single program in Portland, in Oregon, or in the country that has a higher success rate than this guy does right here. And sometimes I actually do not know how he does it, but consistently we're talking about 90 to 100% not just getting housed, but staying housed, and that's how you end youth homelessness. So, questions?
What is your definition of a youth again, the age?
18 to 25.
18. So what happens to those under 18?
We have...
Yes, they're in another service system, typically eligible for state care, but if not, we have two emergency shelters for youth under age 18. One is a very short-term shelter if the police find them on the street. The other one can go out to 30 days as we try and prepare them. The issue with the older, with the younger youth is they can't sign the lease for an apartment, so we have to have them 17 and a half or 18.
That was my next question, Deb. So when you're 18 and of age,
yeah,
they sign the lease or?
Yes.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And then you back that lease?
We pay, we make an agreement with the landlord. We sign a contract saying that, yes, we will pay this rent, but we're not on the lease. We had a trouble. We were going to do a master lease, what's this called, where we sign the lease. We had trouble with landlords having an organization sign the lease, and they literally wanted Dennis to sign the lease. Dennis didn't want to sign the lease. His own name. So
something about credit reports. It's starting to look pretty bad.
Yeah, I can understand that. So, if there's any damage to the property or whatever, on the as a landlord, I know what happens.
We have mitigation funds. I'm not sure if those are going to roll. Michael maybe could help us with that. The landlord mitigation funds, are those still going to be around?
Yeah, so we have a pool of funds, so when we work with a landlord, we can say, rent's guaranteed until they can pay it on their own, and if there's any damage, we'll guarantee...
Up to $3,000.
Carpet being replaced, whatever.
Yes.
Right,
okay. Right.
Yeah.
So you are actually, we'll say, vouching for them.
Yes.
Right.
What length are these leases?
They can be month to month to a year. Whatever the landlord sets is what we abide by. And we have relationships with landlords across the community, and we've developed them. You know, it's a tight housing market right now, so having a homeless youth that doesn't have any income is not highest priority for somebody to house.
Sure.
So we've developed relationships with landlords, and through the landlord mitigation fund, it's saved those relationships over the course of time, where whether we had to buy somebody out of the lease or we had to cover the cost of repairs, it's mostly been helpful on the back end, as opposed to, because the mitigation funds also allow us to pay double the deposit to get them in, or, you know, those kind of things. But it, in our experience, it's always been helpful on the back end. We've had to use it three times over the course of the last year or so.
But we couldn't operate the program if we didn't have the trust of landlords. I mean, that's just the bottom line, because we're not going out saying we're buying the apartment. We're saying we're just going to be like any other renter, but we're going to give support to this youth to be able to stabilize into it. And remember, 90% of them or more are staying in those apartments, so it's working.
And I think people have a kind of bigger heart for youth. Try to give an opportunity. You know.
Are you roommating them?
Sometimes we don't match them up with strangers, just because that we want to set them up for success. Yeah, but if they have friends that they've known for a long time that they think that they can live with, then yes.
But remember, majority are also coming with their own little ones.
Yeah, and sometimes that helps if they both have little ones that they can, you know, do babysitting for each other. And we've had that happen, that where that becomes successful.
Where do they go in the interim?
From
the street to you.
Well, they get referred from the Perch and the Yellowbrick Road, our drop-in center, and then they have to go to the Housing Solutions Center to get an assessment, and then we try to get them housed as soon as possible.
So our case managers for this program also have offices in the Perch, which is the drop-in center. Unfortunately, now, Clark County doesn't have a shelter for this age youth, so that's one of the real service gaps, is that they're sleeping on the street, they're in the Perch, and until they get this housing, they really don't have any other options.
And we have used that.
Let me go ahead and let me finish.
Where is the Perch?
Downtown Vancouver.
Okay, and then, but it's between that time, from the time they're homeless until they get to the Perch, you provide them, or the city provides them with, or they hopefully get into some place like church or whatever, I don't know. What do they do?
Well, a lot of youth don't like to access the adult services because they're afraid of them. So they, even the WHO, they're afraid to stay there with their kids. We've had, the youth are very resourceful. We'll have some that will sleep during the day, and then at night they'll go walk around Walmart. They'll try to stay warm. It's a devastating situation, so we try to house them as quickly as possible. They won't go to our shelters in Portland because they're afraid of them, and a lot of them have kids, and our shelters don't allow for children.
So the hard answer to your question is they don't have an option. which is why this program is so important. It would be great if we had, like in Portland, we have a shelter option where they can stay for up to 4 months while they're coming through this process. But here, they're on the street or they're in a house, and there's nothing.
I have another question, and that, excuse me, but what's the percentage of those with children and those with not? Is there a percentage?
It depends. This program are more hard to reach homeless youth, so they're going to have less children because a lot of them will have their kids taken away by the time we reach them. But the objective is to reunite them with their children after foster care. Right now, it's 50-50. 50 without youth and 50 with youth.
Can we just pass the 4-minute mark of questions, is that why? Go ahead.
I'm sorry, what's that?
I'm just letting everyone know that we just passed the 4-minute mark of questions.
Oh, cool.
And in terms of the other thing, I think it's really, and it was very difficult even for me to get my hands around when we started working here. But this again is the hourglass up here. Understand, we're seeing through our outreach is mobile, so it goes all over the county. That's the purchase stationary, but the outreach is mobile. They go out to camps. Youth will say, "We're camping out here in Battle," and they're going to send somebody out to that area and try and reach them. They make over 1,000 different kids every year. Our outreach program, since we started about 6 years ago, have now almost gone over 10,000 kids, different kids that we have worked with in Clark County. But it takes 5,000 contacts with that 1,000 kids to talk them into service, because these are kids, if you think of it, they're on the street because adults have let them down. Their families let them down. The welfare systems let them down. Whatever they have tried, adults like you and me have failed them. And so it's really, really hard to get trust back into the system. But it takes those 5,000 contacts. But when people say, well, are there really homeless youth in Clark County? First time we ever counted, we counted 52 youth on the street one night. And we thought that was amazing. That was huge. And now it's almost like that's half of how many we see every month in terms of new kids. So this is a very, very invisible but incredibly significant program for this community. And these are literally kids that do not have options, are the ones they have. I was with somebody at the Perch just a couple months ago when we had a grant source coming down to do a new grant. And part of what he said was, where do you sleep at night? And this kid said, he's 23. I've been homeless since I've been 18 in Clark County. I tried Portland a couple times, but it's too dangerous there, so I sleep on the street. And he explained to these people how he sleeps on the busiest street near the curb, because if he sleeps near the building, he's afraid he's going to get arrested, but if he sleeps near the curb, then the police come by and they just tell him to move over because it's not safe. And this is a 23-year-old kid, and he's been doing this for 5 years, so where does he sleep? That's where he goes. And then he says, this Perch, this is the only place I've got. It's kind of like my family, because I can get a meal and get a shower and be safe at least during the day. But at night, we want to do something else. Yeah.
I don't mean to interrupt, but I can just quickly add. So what the Perch and the Yellow Brick Road do is develop trust with these youth that don't have trust with adults. And what we're trying to do with these funds are make sure that we can help assist these youth and foster that relationship that we've already developed before they graduate into the adult system. The reason we developed this program was because we see people that we have relationships for 5 years that just graduate when they're 25, and we never see them again. And we hear that they're on the streets. Our outreach program still sees them, and they're the head of families, street families, but they've never been served. So we want to make sure that we don't lose that trust that we've taken years, 2 to 3 years, 4 years to develop, that we can help house these youth.
How many youth served on this one?
On this one, there's going to be about 40.
About 40?
Yeah.
40 youth and family members, $1 million a year. $1 million lifetime return. I guess.
I can tell you're not passionate about that.
No. And that's why we don't use the PowerPoints, because we need you to listen to us. Because these are, and I think about this, I was talking to this guy, I have 8 children, and 3 of them are out of the foster care system, and 3 of them are my grandchildren we had to adopt because I had a kid who was homeless and drug using on the street when she had those kids. And any of them could easily be in this population. And I just think about it, if they were 12 or 13 and they were on the street, what would we do? So this is very meaningful to me, just at a personal level, because of my life experience of implementing it. So thanks so much.
Okay. I just got a question. As far as, I guess more of an outreach thing. So besides, where do you guys go to get funds? And do you guys go out, like, go out to the communities? I mean, you guys be willing to come out to, like, a council meeting and speak to help get the need out there?
Yeah,
definitely.
Let people know?
Yeah.
Yes.
I mean,
anywhere, anytime. Yeah. In fact, we're working with Longview and Kelso right now. Because Longview has discovered they believe they have an invisible homeless youth problem up there, and they're asking us to help design a shelter that they could develop and then have Scott come up and put these programs in place and then have the outreach workers. And that's where we're starting, is going up to community meetings and talking to people about this is what it looks like, you know, what are you seeing up there? So we will absolutely, literally any time of the day or night, we'll get somebody there. Yeah,
definitely.
That's part of our job, is to help communities see this.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Any sideboards out there with tents?
Surprise. And next we have Sharon.
No, I wouldn't.
Diana Quithy, I'm the executive director of SHARE, and I'm just going to take a couple of minutes because Shannon here is a case manager, and she'll really give you the feel for the whole program and what we do. But SHARE is the largest provider to homeless services in Vancouver. We operate shelters and housing, outreach, meal programs. We have a broad range of services, and so linking into SHARE links all of our clients into that broad range of services as well. The Aspire program began in 2000 with HUD money, and we've had CDBG and home funds in that program for over 10 years. One of the things that I just want to make sure I point out prior to turning it over to the actual program is one of the strategic goals for SHARE in our five-year plan was to develop additional housing for our clients. As you all are aware, it's been in the news. You can't live in Vancouver and not know the horrendous housing problem we have in this community. But my case managers in the Aspire program and the director have cultivated 47 new landlords into a program that already had over 100 landlords. So we work really hard with developing trust of our landlords, and that pays off in the fact that we're able to get our clients into housing faster. It's not fast in Vancouver. It used to take somewhere between 2 and 3 weeks to get a client into housing, and now it takes 6 to 8 weeks. So it is a tremendous shortage of housing in our community that is causing big problems. But I'll let Shannon take over about Aspire.
Thank you. And thank you for funding us this past year and in the past. So the goal of our Aspire program is to provide stable housing and self-sufficiency for those who are participating. And we do this a lot through intensive case management. So we have up to 5 case managers with a caseload of about 30 to 35 clients and families each. We're meeting with them a minimum of once per month, more frequently if it's required to tend to the needs of the client and the family. We're creating and maintaining trusting relationships with them. And as case managers, we are assessing and evaluating the services that these families can access outside in the community as well as within our program. So we're focusing on housing stability and placement and making sure that the short and the long-term goals of our clients are getting met. And then we're also a support and a mediator and a trustworthy interpreter for our clients in accessing services outside of SHARE and Aspire. One of the tools that we use to keep our clients engaged in the program and in case management is a housing stability plan, where we're developing with them short-term, mid-term, and long-term goals. These goals usually work around debt consolidation and budgeting, any kind of credit resolution. A lot of our clients are working on their sobriety or even just basic life skills, mental health needs, and employment goals as well. We are advocates with our families, with the landlords directly, and we also have a SHARE van that we're able to utilize to take our clients out into the community to meet with landlords and to view different apartments if transportation is an issue for our clients. In addition, the Fromhold Center, where we're located, has classrooms where we hold a 6-week tenant education class known as RentWell, and we also provide supporting classes around financial education and employment readiness classes. So Aspire is a program, it's not just a project. And I'd like to just take a few minutes to share with you a success story of somebody who had come through our program on these funds. We had a single mother, Janice, who entered our program with her 7-year-old daughter after spending several years being incarcerated. She had been incarcerated a few times prior, and in this last time, she was in jail for 5 years and at that time had lost custody of her child. When she was released, she came out and she had regained custody of her daughter and was living with a friend who she had trusted and had let her move in. She was paying her rent money directly to this other, to this friend, who she later found out was not using the money to pay rent and had vanished and disappeared. Janice was asked to leave the apartment because she was not on the lease, and at that time she became literally homeless on the streets. Her short-term goal, of course, was to become stably housed, and she went through one of our shelters and got, she became a participant in the Aspire program. And we were able to get her stably housed with her daughter. She met with her case manager weekly in order to provide a really intensive forward motion for her and her family. So they met weekly. She was able to set midterm and long-term goals, and she wanted to develop a realistic budget. She wanted to make a plan to begin to work on a part-time basis, and she was able to do all of that within her time at the Aspire program. She was also able to address her physical health concerns, as well as some mental health concerns and some substance abuse issues in the time that she was on the program. And she was actually, her daughter was having some issues at school. And so she was able to address all of those, her personal issues, as well as getting her daughter on an IEP. She is now has a great relationship with her current landlord. She is no longer in the program. She has graduated the Aspire program. She is still stably housed, and her daughter is excelling in school. They're doing really, really well. She's volunteering with the Humane Society, and she's working with the Department of Vocational Rehabilitation. So thank you.
Cher has about a 79% success rate in clients who come into the program and then never cycle back into the services. We're able to know that through the HMIS system. We participate, so all of our clients can be tracked whether they access our shelter or our programs or other programs in the community. Tried to get you back on track. You're like 25 minutes late. We talk fast. Are there any questions?
I share Mr. Johnson's love of acronyms. What's IEP?
Sorry. It's an individual education plan.
It's what?
An individual education plan. They work with her through the school directly to meet her specific needs.
Usually I see her trying to figure out what they all are.
I know. I'm so sorry. I apologize.
So that's a partnership we have with the school that developed that program.
I don't know what everybody else, but you probably have a question. Mr. Johnson, Mayor Johnson always has a question, but... you guys do a great job.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
So, if I started with you today, mm-hmm. what...
He needs it.
He's a landlord. I don't think so.
what term is the average?
The length of time? So, the average.
Right. Well, the program can go anywhere from 3 months in a rapid rehousing situation mm-hmm. to 24 months.
So at 2 years, it's over.
Yes, and we're constantly aware of those deadlines and working hard with the client to make sure that they can be as successful as the story we told you today.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so the push is on, if you will.
From mm-hmm. day one.
Okay, mm-hmm. to get them back on the straight and narrow.
Right.
And
that way you can bring more clients into that program.
Yes,
exactly.
Yes.
Is that a HUD rule or...
No, so that's best practice. Sorry. So, you know, as a former service provider, you know, generally speaking, you want to provide the minimum level of assistance necessary, you know, that will actually do, you know, help the person succeed. If you provide more than the minimum, that can change completely. You know, that minimum is partly the financial rental system, services. But you never want to over-serve. It doesn't help the person. So, you know, the service provider, in this case, Cher, you know, their case management is in doing their progressive engagement, they're constantly reassessing to not only ask what other support does this person need as they transition to success for them, you know, but also what support structures are no longer necessary and we can remove. You know, so and that's not the county function that I'm telling you. That's just their process of what they're doing. And that's why it's such a big window between 3 months and 24 months.
Some of us has had the opportunity to tour, and we talked about this before, but with the new people, sometimes it might be good to refresh us. And, you know, we're not asking you to provide us with transportation or anything like that, but maybe, you know, we could all travel together.
Sure.
Or something.
We would welcome you at the Frumpholz Service Center.
Well, I think it was beneficial the other day when we were out, when different people were pointing out some of the different projects.
Right.
People were talking about, well, this is a share project over here, and this was a this. And, you know, that's always good to see for, you know, especially some of the new ones, or even us who've been on it for a while now. You see how those funds are being used, and you see the progress that's being made, and
right,
how it's affecting those communities. And you hear from the members in that community where that project was done.
Exactly.
It's very, very helpful.
Yeah, we can try to facilitate that for you.
Well, thank you very much for having us and for your support. We appreciate
it.
Thank you.
So is there any other business?
Before we adjourn, I would just mention that at our next meeting, of course, we're doing the scoring. We'll have the funding hopefully nailed down of what we're going to allocate. And then we're also going to have Trish McConaughey with our department is going to present, I don't know if we've mentioned this to you guys before, the draft mission. We've developed a mission and values for the Department of Community Services, and we've been asking all of our advisory boards to provide feedback, see if there's anything that was missed. Our director just really wants to have a broad outreach as we do our strategic planning. So she'll take probably about an hour to go over that at the March meeting after we do the scoring and the awarding.
So the Janice and Cher, they have a CDBG number and a home number. Do they both need to be approved to get both of those funds?
I believe so, because the CDBG is used for the case management to support the home that can only be used for the rental assistance.
So with any of these projects, if you choose not to fully fund them, or even if like one of those, if you didn't fund, we want to fund the case management but not the rental assistance, or whatever you choose, you know, that really is, you know, your choice. And what we would do is inform, you know, ask the entity that submitted the proposal, saying, you know, at this level of funding, is your project still viable? And that's really up to them to give us that feedback at that point.
Okay. Yeah, so March meeting will go a little bit longer.
Yeah.
All right. And motion to adjourn then?
I make a motion that we adjourn.
And so we'll put in the objective scoring into Zoom grants, and you guys will be putting your scores in before the March meeting, so that part should go pretty smoothly. We'll have all the projects already ranked and ready to look at and talk about.
When will that be updated?
Well, you can go in there and do your scores at any time, but we'll add the objective scores probably at least a week before the March 14th meeting.
But we don't need your objective.
You don't need our objective scores.
Can you see
our?
You can't even see them, I don't think, can you?
What's
we other? I mean, previously, I don't think you
really.
Are you saying ours are subject?
26 or
something. 26 in February? For
their scores.
Yeah, so what we previously,
yeah, yeah,
we'll send this out in the email again, was the 26th of February was the date that we asked you to have your scores in by, and we'll have ours in again as well.
Okay.